From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
As voters go to the polls in Wyoming and Alaska, is this Liz Cheney's last stand and Sarah Palin's second act? Plus, President Biden signs the Inflation Reduction Act. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnist Kim Strassel and editorial writer Manet Ukwe-Barua. Welcome to you both. Tuesday's Republican primary in Wyoming is one of the most hotly anticipated of the year. But oddly, the result seems to be in little doubt at this point. There's a recent poll by the University of Wyoming that gives Liz Cheney about 28% of the vote and her challenger, Harriet Hageman, about 57% of the vote. So let's listen to these two candidates a little bit. We'll start with Liz Cheney, and this is a piece of her final message to voters from her website.
Like many candidates across this country, my opponents in Wyoming have said that the 2020 election was rigged and stolen. No one who understands our nation's laws, no one with an honest, honorable, genuine commitment to our Constitution would say that. It is a cancer that threatens our great republic. If we do not condemn these lies, if we do not hold those responsible to account, we will be excusing this conduct, and it will become a feature of all elections. America will never be the same.
And here's a piece of Harriet Hageman speaking to a crowd at a rally in May.
We're fed up with the January 6th Commission and those people who think that they can gaslight us. We're fed up with those types of Republicans who work harder to deflect attention from the failures of the current administration than they work to protect us from it. And we're fed up with Liz Cheney.
Kim, what do you make of the choice facing Wyoming voters and the argument that each of these candidates is making?
Well, a couple of things just to know about Wyoming, least populous state in the nation, but where registered GOP voters outnumber Democrats by 4-1 and where Donald Trump won nearly 70% of the vote. And I think that that probably explains that poll that you are seeing. A lot of this has got tied up, obviously, in the January 6th committee. And I think what has frustrated a lot of Wyoming voters, if you talk to them, it's not necessarily that Cheney has been critical of Trump. And I truly believe that if she had voted her conscience and stopped just with her impeachment vote and left it at that, that this would look a lot different. It'd be a much more competitive race. But a lot of voters have been very offended that she decided to join this committee even after Pelosi had vetoed Kevin McCarthy's picks to it. And then some of the tactics that have come out of the committee, subpoenas for fellow Republicans in the House, the decision to hold these hearings primetime, the optics of her being seen sitting next to prominent Democrats who Republicans have really come to scorn, guys like Adam Schiff. And in light of all that, it doesn't really surprise me that much that this is where we're headed. And by the way, I doubt it surprises Liz Cheney, who seems to be on a little bit of a kamikaze mission.
One interesting dynamic will be that some of Cheney's supporters have been urging Democrats in Wyoming to cross the aisle and vote in the Republican primary so that they can vote for her. But as Kim suggests, there simply aren't enough of them, it seems, to make the difference and save Cheney's seat here. But to the other point Kim makes is that it seems like she has embraced this role, Manet. She's not hedging her rhetoric at all. And one remarkable thing was to watch this ad that her father, former Vice President Dick Cheney, cut that is pulling no punches. Let's listen to a piece of that.
In our nation's 246-year history, there has never been an individual who is a greater threat to our republic than Donald Trump. He tried to steal the last election using lies and violence to keep himself in power after the voters had rejected him. He is a coward. A real man wouldn't lie to his supporters. He lost his election and he lost big. I know it, he knows it, and deep down, I think most Republicans know it. Lynn and I are so proud of Liz for standing up for the truth, doing what's right, honoring her oath to the Constitution when so many in our party are too scared to do so.
Manet, to me, it sounds like Liz Cheney has known for a long time that she's not going to win this, but she's been intending to go down swinging.
I think that's right for sure. I mean, from the perspective of political strategy, I think it's important to remember that when Liz Cheney first took her very aggressive anti-Trump stance, that probably was not a political calculation whatsoever. I think she's given the public every reason to believe that she's completely sincere in wanting to hold President Trump accountable for the role that he might have played in the January 6th riot, to participate in the committee because she wants to help to bring some of those details to the surface. I think a lot of Republicans are right to say that she has gone too far by allying with the Democrats to participate in a political assassination that hurts the Republican Party. But nonetheless, when she first decided to go down that road, I think she was doing it because she really believed it was the right thing to do. And she probably didn't anticipate that the political consequences of taking that stance would be as dramatic as they were. Of course, she had seen people like Jeff Flake have their political careers ended by putting themselves at odds with President Trump. But I think that she probably thought the January 6th committee was so lurid that it would be somewhat unifying in the American consciousness and that there would be a little bit more space for people to take an anti-Trump position on that. But time has kind of proven her wrong about that. But in the context of the primary and her quest to be reelected in Wyoming, I think that by now it's certainly obvious to her that the vast majority of Republican voters in her state don't share her perspective on President Trump and January 6th. But the fact that she has, instead of trying to bridge the gap and say, hey, I've served you faithfully as a conservative Republican for all these years, we might disagree about Trump, but look at my track record here. She's actually leaned into her anti-Trump position and made that the centerpiece of her campaign, I think does prove that she certainly, you know, does not think she's likely to be reelected, and that she probably is kind of positioning herself for what her life is going to look like outside of Congress. And that might be the usual retired politician route of saying, I want to, you know, basically continue to participate in the elite inside the Beltway world and potentially building some alliances here with Democrats and progressives in the media. Or it could be gearing up for some kind of independent third party run. I think that the odds on that second option would be pretty slim, that she'd be very unlikely to have success there. But who knows, you know, that could be something that she intends to do and potentially become a spoiler in 2024.
Kim, what do you make of that idea? This has been floated in the media, and Liz Cheney has occasionally said things like, I will make that decision when the time comes, which is not a no. If someone asks you if you're running for president in 2024 and you don't say no, then the answer seems to be maybe, I'm thinking about it. Do you think that that's a step that she would potentially take within the Republican Party as an independent, or what would that look like?
It probably is on the table. One thing that she seems to have made pretty clear, which has been reported in the press, that her conversations have revolved around the idea that if she loses this race, that whatever she does next will somehow be committed to continuing her cause of ensuring that Donald Trump is not reelected as president. Now, that could be in a lot of different forms. Some people have talked about running a giant super PAC, for instance, that ran ads against him or supported an opponent of his. Yes, she could potentially make a run herself. Now, that is an enormous endeavor. Not saying that she couldn't do it. She certainly has carved out a name for herself among never Trumpers, of which there is an organized community, including some prominent people. Then you'd have to choose, yes, do you go head-to-head in a Republican primary? That could be a pretty grueling experience, especially because, as you can see, a lot of members of the Republican Party are still very much Trump advocates. The other road, as you note, would be an independent bid. But then you have to ask yourself, would Liz Cheney, could she actually act as the role of a spoiler in a general election? A lot of people like to point out that, you know, these elections are so close, a few thousand votes here or there. Maybe, yeah, except for then you also have to look at the kind of people that would vote for her. They'd obviously be people that probably were attracted to her because they somewhat detested Trump anyway. So are these votes that she'd actually be pulling away from him in any way? Or would she instead be splitting votes with a Democrat who was running in the election? That's a harder thing to call, but all of that will probably be factoring into her decision about what she does next.
My last thought on this is, if Harriet Hageman does indeed win the nomination, I'll be interested to see how she conducts herself after and if she adjusts her rhetoric at all. So throughout this campaign, she has been a little equivocal on the claims of a stolen election. And that changed earlier this month on August 4th. Here's a report in the Casper Star Tribune. Absolutely, the election was rigged. It was rigged to make sure that President Trump could not get reelected, Hageman said on stage. What happened in 2020 was a travesty. And the newspaper says this was her clearest public stance on the integrity of the presidential election so far. I have two thoughts on that. One is she was already way ahead in the polls by the beginning of August. So if she hadn't taken that kind of a stance so far, it's confusing to me why she felt the need to do it, you know, only a week and a half or two before the actual primary voting. But it does seem to me also, Manet, that there are some candidates who just realize that that is what a lot of Republican voters want to hear. Those are kind of the table stakes in a Republican primary, and we'll have to see how they turn to adjust their rhetoric after they win the nomination.
Right. It is an interesting test case because, as Kim was pointing out, Wyoming is one of the reddest states in the country. President Trump won re-election there with almost 70% of the vote. And so if Harriet Hageman gets the nomination, she certainly won't be under any political pressure to pivot back to the center. We will be seeing basically the message that she wants to run on, you know, the message that she wants to communicate to voters. And it will be interesting to see whether she dialed up the rhetoric on President Trump and came out and said explicitly that the election was stolen, really just to lock up the primary, to distinguish herself as much as possible from Liz Cheney, or whether that's something that she really has become convinced of, and it's a message that she's going to continue to repeat, and whether she would enter Congress as a voice on the inside, continuing to talk about election conspiracy theories. I don't know if any of us know the answer to that question, but it will be something that people should continue to pay attention to, both in that race and with other Republican nominees.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Also on Tuesday, voters are going to the polls in Alaska, with one prominent name on the ballot being Sarah Palin. Kim, can you tell us what the story is here?
Yes. Poor Alaskan voters have a very difficult Tuesday voting date. One thing they're going to do is they're going to engage in their first ranked choice ballot, an election that is a general election to fill the remainder of Don Young's seat. So this is going to be the person who sits in that seat just for the few months until we get to the end of this Congress. On the ballot is Sarah Palin. Also, Nick Begich, who is the son of a very prominent Democratic family, although he is a Republican. That's been a little bit of a challenge for him, is telling everyone that he's not like all of the other elected politicians from his family in the state. And then also Mary Pattola, who is a Democrat. And so Alaskans are going to have to rank their choices for these three. It's going to be very interesting. When they had the jungle primary to come up with these names, Palin came out on top with 27% of the vote, Begich with 19%. There was another candidate who ran as an independent named Al Gross. He got 13% of the vote, and he has since dropped out. And so then Mary Pattola. So there's these three. Certain polls have suggested that Palin, who's got great name recognition, has been fading a little bit. She has a lot of legacy in the state and name recognition, but a lot of people also feel that she kind of abandoned them after she dropped out of politics. So that's cutting against her. And then completely separate from that, Alaskans are also voting in a jungle primary for a whole bunch of bigger races too, the Senate race, the governor's race, and also they're voting again for Don Young's seat, for who will fill the full 2-year term.
And one thing to watch with these new ranked choice voting situations is the number of exhausted ballots, because just to remind people how this works, sometimes they call it instant runoff voting. And you have candidates, you can rank them, say, I want this person first, this person second, this person third, and so on. And then if nobody gets above 50%, the bottom person is eliminated and all of those tallies are reshuffled. And they keep doing that until somebody gets above a majority threshold. And one of the questions that always comes up when new cities and states try this is, A, how many people filled out the ballots incorrectly and had their ballots thrown out or rejected as a result? And B, how many people, when you get to the end of this reshuffling process, have their ballots set to the side, not because they did anything wrong, but because all of the candidates they supported have been eliminated?
And in the New York mayoral race last year, the mayoral primary, Democratic primary, at the end, there were something like 140,000 inactive ballots. And so I'll be curious, Manet, to see how that plays out in Alaska. And my thought, I guess, is they call this instant runoff voting, but it gets a little complicated. And I'm not sure what the problem with old-fashioned runoff voting was.
Right. I mean, the thing with the ranked choice balloting is that it basically rewards the voters who are the most consumed with the political process, who are most educated about the way that ranked choice works, but then also who dedicate the time to understanding every single candidate in the field and developing a clear preference about how to rank them. So ranked choice voting doesn't require that every voter list all candidates to fill every number of available slots. And so in many cases, you do have voters who say, really, I've only heard of two out of these four candidates. I have no preference about the other two, so I'm just going to list my top two. But that means that if their top two candidates aren't among those who make it into the later rounds of the field, their vote gets entirely set aside. So basically, it gives an advantage to the voters who are willing and able to spend the most time and pour themselves into researching the election. But of course, we know that these are complicated things. Voters are ordinary people who have ordinary lives, and not everybody has the time to dedicate to learning every single candidate in the field and deciding what their preference is. So yeah, the New York ranked choice mayoral election in 2021 was certainly a messy one. You actually had the city government spending millions of dollars on educational campaigns to inform voters how the system works. And anytime you're in that territory, basically having to communicate how the election works at the same time you're conducting the election, you have to ask yourself, wouldn't it be simpler to just stick with the older system that voters understand and know that in the end, we're going to have a candidate who is chosen by the people in a very clear way, as opposed to kind of running an experiment with the way that we vote.
Finally, the news in Washington Tuesday is that President Biden is signing the Inflation Reduction Act, which again is the name of this legislation that includes tax increases and climate spending and more money for the IRS. Kim, we've talked a good deal about this legislation and what's in it, but how do you think that each side is feeling as it is now getting signed into law? And I would note that the Republican Party has already cut sort of an ad based on the number of IRS agents and auditors that are likely to be hired as a result of this.
Yeah, just one last thing on ranked choice voting. One other problem with this system, I just have to throw it out there because it's a bugaboo of mine, is that it completely blows up the party system in that it allows candidates to avoid having to be held accountable by their own voters within that party. A good example is Lisa Murkowski is running for re-election for the Senate race in Alaska. Because of the jungle primary, she did not have to go head-to-head with her conservative opponent, Kelly Sobacca. She got to sort of skate through as part of all four candidates that advance to a general election. She will likely do that. And then if she gets to the ranked choice ballot, there's a potential where a lot of Democrats will rank her highly and she'll be able to come out on top of everything. This is one of the frustrations with the systems, too. But on to Washington. The Democrats and all of the media has sold this as a pure up win for Biden. It's a victory. Look at his legislative achievements. Democrats have something to go out and sell voters this fall. I guess so. But I think the problem from their perspective, or the political problem for them, is that Republicans are going to be out there saying that this is simply more of the awful that got us high inflation. Look, there's a whole nother tranche of spending. As you said, there are certain provisions in this bill that are already very unpopular with voters, like the idea of supersizing the IRS. And so I think they got plenty out of this bill to campaign on as well, too. We'll have to see as we go forward in the next couple of months how this works. But if inflation remains high, I think that this is kind of a gamble for Democrats.
Let's spare a moment, though, before we move on, for the SALT Democrats in the House. And when this bill passed the House on Friday, they voted for it after making the argument, Manet. These are Democrats from high-tax jurisdictions, New York, New Jersey, California. They have said that they wouldn't vote for any tax changes to the tax code, unless they uncapped the deduction for state and local taxes. And just as a reminder to people how this works, it ends up acting as a subsidy for these kinds of jurisdictions, because Trenton and Albany and Sacramento can raise their taxes by a dollar. They can raise their taxes by a dollar without inflicting a dollar's worth of pain on their residence, because some of that is going to get deducted and essentially subsidized from the federal treasury. And Monet, I guess I'm not surprised that the SALT Democrats decided to go along with this bill anyway, but I am a little bit surprised at the flimsy justifications that they're using.
Right. To their credit, I would point out that the red line that you saw drawn by congressmen like Gottheimer in New Jersey and Swazi in New York was that we don't want to go along with any personal income tax increases unless we get a lift or elimination of the cap on the state and local tax deduction. And the version of Build Back Better that the Democrats are about to sign into law doesn't include rate increases on individuals. So that's the line that they're saying, yes, we failed to get the change to the SALT deduction cap that we were seeking, but the reason we aren't sort of willing to tank the bill for that is because our fellow Democrats agreed not to raise any individual rates. The taxes that you do see going up in this version of the bill are on stock buybacks and on corporations for their book income. So it's a little bit of a discrepancy. But at the same time, I think we can put it in context and say that, yeah, there are a lot of sort of Democrats who have gone along with leadership because the party feels like it's desperate to have a legislative accomplishment and who would have liked to get their own priorities sort of taken care of in the bill, but ended up just having to fall in line. And that's something we've seen time and again sort of in Pelosi's Washington. And so the leadership and President Biden have scored another victory here. But a lot of the Democrats across the country who claim to be moderate and looking out for the interests of sort of more centrist voters have really failed to make good on that promise.
Well, Monet, I think you might be going a little bit too easy on these guys. I mean, here's the unequivocal statement from Josh Gottheimer and Mikey Sherrill. This is from January. We support the president's agenda, and if there are any efforts that include a change in the tax code, then a SALT fix must be part of it. No SALT, no deal. So now that they're saying, well, we really only meant the personal tax code, to me, it looks a little lawyerly. But Kim, all eyes, it seems, are back on Joe Manchin, because he had promised that he would vote for this in exchange for some sort of permitting reforms. We don't have a great idea about what those permitting reforms might look like. But notable to me that as soon as this Inflation Reduction Act was about to pass the House, Democrats in the House were casting doubt on any permitting reform. And here's a quote from Congressman Raul Grijalva, and he's talking to The Hill. He said, I didn't shake hands. I wasn't part of the negotiations. Kim saying that he feels no obligation to go along with whatever Joe Manchin says he was promised. And so where do you think this goes, Kim? And we'll give you the last word.
Well, everyone's on vacation at the moment, and I guess we'll really see how this pans out when they get back in September. But look, we've pointed this out on the show numerous times. The notion that Democrats who, you know, live in fealty to environmental groups were going to roll over and give Joe Manchin these provisions in permitting and other things is crazy. And it's interesting to me that he doesn't really have a lot of leverage, at least not in the short term. Now, one thing to remember, Democrats still have some things they would like to get done before elections. Some things may get pushed on into a lame duck, but even then, Joe Manchin is going to be the 50th vote. So, you know, on appropriations, on riders in appropriations, you can put policy riders into appropriations. We'll see where he takes this. I find it hard to believe that he's going to be able to get across a standalone legislation, but is there some way to slip something into a deal? Because the added complications is Republicans are very unhappy with him right now. And while they might like some of the permitting reforms he put forward, they will not want to be seen to be rewarding him for having cut this deal.
Thank you, Kim. And thank you, Monet. And thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button, and we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.